Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're really digging into three major interconnected dynamics playing out right now, late 2025, involving Russia, Ukraine, and the West.
That's right. We've got quite a bit of source material showing some significant shifts.
Yeah, and our goal here is to really cut through the noise, look at what these sources are telling us, and pull out the key insights for you.
Absolutely. And we're focusing on three main areas. First, there's a really big strategic change coming out of Kyiv. They're stepping up support for non-Russian national movements inside Russia.
Yeah.
Second, we need to look at how the Kremlin is hitting back internally, basically equating political dissent with, well, terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty stark.
Wow. Okay. And third?
And third, we'll analyze how parts of the Russian elite are making some very calculated moves, signaling towards specific political figures in the U.S.
Right. So quite a bit to unpack there. Let's start with Kyiv's strategy then. You mentioned this shift towards backing national movements within Russia.
Yes, it's a move towards openly supporting what they're calling the decolonization of Russia. It's becoming much more explicit.
And why is this happening now? What's the thinking behind it?
Well, it seems to be driven by two things. On one hand, it's tactical, putting internal pressure on Moscow to hopefully help defeat the current invasion.
Makes sense.
But there's a deeper long-term goal, too. Security. The argument from Kyiv is that Ukraine can never be truly secure as long as Russia remains an empire.
So the idea is that decolonization is the only way to end the threat permanently.
That's exactly the conviction. They believe the imperial structure itself is the root problem.
Now, this isn't totally out of the blue, right? Ukraine has had some focus on these groups since 91, and especially after 2014 and 2022.
True, but past actions were, let's say, more limited. Declarations, maybe providing safe haven for some leaders, forming some small non-Russian units fighting for Ukraine.
But nothing like direct institutional backing.
Not on this scale. And even those earlier, smaller steps led Moscow to crack down harder internally on those groups.
Which brings us to the legislative change you mentioned. What's happening in the Verkhovna Rada, Ukraine's parliament?
So back in September 2024, a draft bill passed its first reading. It's expected to get full approval soon. And this bill basically directs the Ukrainian government to significantly ramp up support material, institutional, you name it, for these non-Russian movements.
So moving from maybe passive sympathy to active enablement.
Precisely. It's a formalization of policy shift.
That feels like a really significant step. But surely Kyiv knows this idea, actively promoting the decolonization or breakup of Russia, alarms some of their Western partners. You know, that the old fears about instability, loose nukes.
Oh, absolutely. They know the risks. But the justification we're seeing is framed as survival. Volodymyr Vyacherovich, you might remember him, former head of the Ukrainian Institute of National Remembrance, put it very bluntly.
What did he say?
He argued, Ukraine has a vital interest in this. And I'm quoting him here. Only when Russia ceases to be an empire will it cease to be a threat. He even tried to quantify it. He suggested that every hryvnia that's Ukrainian currency, competently invested in national movements, now could save tens and hundreds of hryvnias later on fighting a consolidated Russian empire.
So a stark cost-benefit analysis, essentially. What kind of support does the bill actually propose?
It outlines things like formally recognizing their right to independence, actively coordinating with movements both abroad and within their homelands, and providing things like training and other assistance. It's quite comprehensive.
And this isn't just happening domestically in Ukraine. You mentioned an international dimension, too.
Yes, and this is the second key development happening almost in parallel. On October 1st, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, PACE, adopted a resolution.
Okay. PACE, the big European Human Rights and Democracy Forum. What did the resolution do?
It established something called a platform for dialogue with Russian democratic forces in exile. Basically, a formal structure for engaging with the Russian opposition abroad.
Interesting. But what's the link to Kyiv's strategy?
Here's the crucial part. Ukraine successfully pushed for a specific clause to be included. It mandates that at least 30% of the participants on this platform must be representatives from non-Russian national movements.
Wow. So Kyiv basically embedded its decolonization focus right into this major European platform.
They did. It's a significant diplomatic achievement for them. But as you can imagine, it's also highly controversial.
How so?
Well, you have the non-Russian activists saying, look, democratization in Russia is impossible without decolonization. The two have to go hand in hand.
Okay.
But many Russian liberal figures oppose this 30% quota. They worry that this stance questioning Russia's existing borders will just push ordinary Russians further towards Putin.
Because it feeds the narrative that the opposition wants to break up the country.
Exactly. And there's also distrust from the non-Russian groups, who often feel that many Russian liberals are, deep down, just as committed to maintaining the empire as the Kremlin is.
So it exposes a real fracture within the broader Russian opposition movement itself. A very high-stakes diplomatic play by Kyiv.
Definitely.
Okay, so that's the pressure coming from Ukraine. Now let's pivot. How is Moscow reacting to all this? You mentioned a chilling internal crackdown.
Yes, it seems timed, perhaps, partly in response to things like that PACE-E platform. We saw a major move on October 14th, 2025. The FSB, Russia's security service, formally charged the Russian Anti-War Committee.
That's the group with many prominent exiles, right? Khodorkovsky, Kasparov.
Exactly. And the charges are stunning. Organizing a terrorist group and attempting a coup d'etat.
Wait, terrorism? For an anti-war committee made up of, you know, public figures, intellectuals, former politicians, how are they even justifying that? They're equating them with groups like Al-Qaeda or ISIS.
That's effectively what the charge implies. It's a massive escalation. Yep. The list of targets includes Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who they singled out, former Prime Minister Mikhail Kasyanov, the economist Sergei Alexashenko, Garry Kasparov, the satirist Viktor Shenderovich, commentator Ekaterina Shulman, even Vladimir Kara-Murza, who was only recently released.
And the justification.
Putin's spokesperson, Dmitry Peskov, simply said these individuals were engaged in hostile activities. It's incredibly broad.
How does this compare historically? Is this like the later Soviet era, charging dissidents with anti-Soviet activities?
Actually, the sources suggested something different, and maybe more ominous. It feels less like the Brezhnev era charges against dissidents, and more like Stalin's approach to the Trotskyists.
How so?
Treating them not just as ideological opponents, but as primary political enemies, almost like foreign agents, actively working to overthrow the state through violence. Hence the terrorism charge. And the timing, coming shortly after the PACE-E platform was announced.
Suggests they're sending a clear message. Engage with this decolonization talk, even in exile, and you'll be branded an international terrorist.
That seems to be exactly the signal. Moscow wants to shut down this entire discussion globally.
And this isn't just about charges filed in Russia, is it? They're actively trying to reach these people abroad. We know Interpol often pushed back on politically motivated extradition requests from Russia.
Right. Interpol was becoming a hurdle for Moscow, especially for charges like spreading fake news about the war, which are obviously political. So they found a workaround.
Which is?
Since 2022, they've been very busy signing a whole series of bilateral extradition treaties with individual countries. This lets them bypass Interpol scrutiny.
Creating a sort of parallel system. Which countries are we talking about?
It's quite a list, and it paints a picture.
Mm-hmm.
They're focusing on countries that are, let's say, less concerned with due process or the political nature of charges. Think Algeria, Vietnam, Iraq, Iran, China, Mozambique, Myanmar, Nicaragua.
A lot of authoritarian states or countries with strained relations with the West.
Exactly. Saudi Arabia, Tajikistan, Tanzania, Angola, Venezuela, Egypt, Cambodia, North Korea, Kyrgyzstan, Cuba, Laos, Morocco, Thailand, the Central African Republic. Even Chile is on the list. Over 24 countries so far.
Creating a global web, essentially, where exiles might not be safe. And presumably, they're not using overtly political charges in these requests.
No, that's the tactic. They cook up seemingly ordinary criminal charges to mask the political motive. There was a recent case involving an activist named Lilia Manekina.
What happened?
She fled Russia after putting up anti-war leaflets. She was then detained in Armenia based on a Russian request. But the charge wasn't political. It was theft of weapons by a group using violence.
Something clearly fabricated to fit the extradition requirements.
Almost certainly. These bilateral deals allow them to make such requests without the level of international legal oversight Interpol might provide. It's a very concerning strategy for Russian dissidents abroad.
Deeply worrying. Okay, let's shift to the third major dynamic we flagged. The Russian elites signaling towards the U.S., specifically towards Donald Trump. What's going on there? Why this sudden flurry of, well, flattering attention?
It's quite a performance, really. And while Trump himself is obviously an audience, the primary audience for all this signaling seems to be Vladimir Putin himself. Putin, according to these sources, still holds out hope for some kind of grand bargain, a landmark deal with Washington. So key figures in the elite are essentially auditioning for Putin.
Trying to show they're useful, that they understand his thinking, that they can maybe open doors with the right people in the U.S.
Exactly. Proving their loyalty and anticipating his desires. And one key tactic is this heavily pushed conservative values angle.
Right. We've seen Putin himself making complimentary remarks about Trump several times just this October.
Yes, but it goes deeper. It involves using cultural figures, too.
Yeah.
For instance, Bishop Tikhon, who many believe is Putin's personal confessor, wrote an article recently.
About what?
Praising Charlie Kirk, the U.S. right-wing activist who was murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Tikhon called Kirk courageous, someone going against the grain of what he termed militant liberalism.
That's very specific signaling.
It gets more explicit. Kirill Dmitriev, the head of the Russian Direct Investment Fund, basically a key state-controlled investment vehicle and sometimes an informal channel to the West, made sure to publicize Tikhon's article. Dmitriev also promoted a piece by Alexander Dugin, the extreme nationalist philosopher. And Dmitriev publicly stated that Russia would cherish Kirk's memory.
Wow. So the message is, we share your cultural enemies, we're on the same side against liberalism. A direct appeal to the American right, trying to build a values-based bridge.
That appears to be exactly the play. Trying to frame Russia under Putin as a bastion of conservative values aligned with certain segments of U.S. politics.
And it's not just about values talk, right? There are concrete proposals being floated, too.
Oh, yes. Dmitriev has been particularly active, offering, dozens of potential deals, things like cooperation on rare earth metals, joint projects in the Arctic. He even floated the old idea of building a tunnel under the Bering Strait.
A tunnel? Really? Seems a bit ambitious.
Well, it's about generating headlines and suggesting potential areas for grand bargains, and it's coordinated. Even Nikolai Patrushev, the former Security Council secretary, usually known for his hardline views.
Yeah, typically very hawkish.
Suddenly started talking publicly about joint U.S.-Russian solutions for Arctic challenges.
Yeah.
It's a noticeable shift in tone.
And they're hitting other themes, too.
Definitely. There's been a lot of praise directed at Elon Musk. Talk about cooperation with NASA. Dmitriev, Peskov, the head of Roscosmos, Dmitry Bakunov. They've all chimed in. It seems directly targeted because they know Trump has expressed interest in space exploration and technology.
So they're tailoring the message to specific interests they perceive Trump has. But what's the actual status of any dialogue? You mentioned the Alaska summit didn't yield much, and there's talk of a Budapest meeting, but it seems vague.
It does seem tenuous. In fact, Deputy Foreign Minister Ryabkov recently made comments suggesting the impulse for negotiation had kind of run its course.
Okay, so maybe a dose of realism there.
Well, that comment was immediately contradicted by the top circle. Putin himself, Peskov, Dmitriev, even presidential aide Yuri Ushakov, they all jumped in to insist that no, Trump absolutely still has the political will for peace talks, especially over Ukraine.
So they quickly slapped down any suggestion that the door might be closing. They need to keep that possibility alive, at least publicly.
It seems crucial to their current strategy. They cannot afford to signal that the channel is dead.
And we saw recently how this persistence can, in a way, pay off for them, didn't we?
We did. When Putin made some complimentary remarks about Trump's supposed skills in crisis resolution, Trump responded almost immediately.
Oh.
He shared a clip of Putin's comments online and simply wrote, "Thank you to President Putin."
Which is exactly the kind of positive feedback loop the Russian elite seems to be aiming for. It validates their efforts in Putin's eyes.
Precisely. It shows they can generate a reaction, keep the potential channel open, however tenuously.
Okay, so let's pull these threads together. We've got Kyiv dramatically escalating its strategy to support decolonization inside Russia. We have the Kremlin responding with an equally dramatic internal crackdown, labeling dissenters as terrorists and building a global extradition network. And then we have this calculated charm offensive from the Russian elite towards specific U.S. political figures. These aren't isolated events.
No, they're absolutely interconnected. Kyiv's push on decolonization, formalizing it through law, embedding it in that PACE platform is happening, even though they know it risks deeper repression from Moscow and potentially unsettling Western allies who fear a Russian collapse.
Meanwhile, Moscow isn't just using rhetoric. They're deploying a concrete legal strategy, those bilateral extradition deals, the trumped-up criminal charges to try and neutralize opposition globally.
Right. And what's really striking is Ukraine's apparent calculation here. They seem to have decided that the risk of provoking Moscow now is actually less dangerous in the long run than continuing to live next to an unreformed imperial Russian state.
That conviction you mentioned earlier, Vygotrovich's point about a hryvnia invested now saving hundreds later, seems to be driving policy. So a final thought for our listeners to consider. Given these aggressive new tactics the Kremlin is using against exiles, the extradition deals, the terrorism charges, what happens if Ukraine's new law actually translates into substantial financial or material support flowing to these national movements inside Russia?
How might Moscow react beyond the current repression? And what does this mean for those Russian opposition figures, perhaps sitting right now in places like Yerevan or Bangkok or Cairo, knowing their host country has signed one of those bilateral agreements with Moscow? What options do they really have left?
Serious questions with potentially life or death implications, something to definitely keep an eye on as these dynamics continue to unfold.